You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast with myself and Walker. In this episode, I've taken some listener feedback over the past few weeks, and a number of you have reached out and asked if I would do or have a conversation with a colleague or indeed someone who had insight into sexual assault and rape, as there's really not much in paramedic practice or indeed educational practice informing pre-hospital clinicians about this. So in this conversation, I'm speaking with Jane Butler, who is the CEO of Rape Crisis. She is a fantastic advocate for services to both support and indeed mitigate some of the of this pathology. And indeed, what we do in the conversation is look into the immediate, midterm and long-term effects of sexual assault. We look at the prevalence. We also examine safe elements of safeguarding, care pathways, and the components of forensics, which paramedics and pre-hospital providers should be aware of. Also, we talk about some of the psychological support mechanisms, some indeed that Rape Crisis provide, others that are readily available. We'll put these in the show notes as well. So Jane is a fantastic guest. She is an experienced voluntary sector leader, and she has been in non-for-profits and indeed justice-focused organisations for about 20 years. She has influenced work up and down the scale, so involved in designing, fundraising and managing frontline services. She's also been a strategic consultant in a range of voluntary sector organisations and a member of trustee and number of membership infrastructural organisations. So this includes the Comfrey Project, North East Law Centre, Relate in Northumberland, Teesside, the Newcastle United Foundation and the Children's Society. She has also developed and networked a response to the COVID-19 pandemic from some of her contacts within income and development, and indeed she is a fellow of the RSA. So like I said in the conversation, we just look at the anatomy of sexual assault and the prevalence and some of the dynamics and the second and third order effects as well. I hope you gain some insight from this conversation, and please check out the show notes for links to further services. And I, needless to say, just want to remain open to any more feedback really. So any topics that you'd like me to cover in the future, I will put my email at the end of the in the show notes, so please do feel free to reach out for any further topics. Here's my conversation with CEO of Rape Crisis, Jane Butler. Jane, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you with me. Jane, I wonder if you could just first speak to just the psychological needs of someone who's maybe indeed just undergone or suffered sexual assault.
Yeah, sure. So people can present really differently if they've just experienced sexual assault. So you might come across someone who's feeling really scared, very upset, very angry, and really showing those emotions. Equally so, you could come across somebody who's very numb, confused, unsure. But I think primarily we're looking, either of those states, you really want to make sure that they're getting reassurance and that they feel safe and that they're in a space where they can trust you. In that aftermath, regardless of how they're presenting in terms of their behaviours.
I think that psychological safety is absolutely key. And I think, yeah, again, that probably calls forward a lot of non-technical skills about reassurance, being at patient level, so eye lines are not standing over people, and just really, yeah, giving people time to unpack. And we'll maybe go into maybe some of these sort of nuances slightly bit later. Jane, could you speak to indeed the prevalence that you're seeing indeed either within your service at the moment or indeed nationally?
So in terms of the national picture, around one in four women have experienced sexual assault and one in 20 men. So it's huge. And that's maybe in as an adult across their lifetime. And we also know that about one in six children have experienced sexual abuse. So the prevalence in terms of sexual violence that people are experiencing, it's huge. It's a wide scale problem. It's vastly underreported to the police. So you don't necessarily see that prevalence, even though we hear about lots of rape and sexual assault being reported to the police. Of course, that's not the pathway for everyone. And it's not an automatic assumption that people will do that. We also see a lot of people who will present to a service user for the first time, sorry, to a service for the first time. Some of them will do that immediately. So you might get somebody who's seeking healthcare after an immediate incident, but you might also find somebody who is doing that much later, and maybe something's happened that's triggered that. They've bumped into somebody who they recognised as being their perpetrator, and they have a panic attack, for example. The incident might have happened some time ago, but they might not be, you know, they might not have sought help right in that moment. We know that with trauma, that time can be a strange thing. It doesn't always mean that that trauma response comes immediately. It can come much later, and that wish to seek help or to disclose might come much later.
So there are many touch points, Jane, to your last point around, you know, time being a differentiator, and it's different for every victim and or patient. Could you maybe speak to some of the wider considerations? So, you know, paramedic gets on scene, and the victim may feel like they don't want to disclose much, or indeed seek help. And indeed, it just might take a lot of time to unpack. But could you maybe just speak to the wider considerations around the touch points that are available, signposting, or just the wider implications that might be available to paramedics outside of that really potted, narrow 1 hour, 1.5 hour consultation?
Yeah, sure. So we know that you might be concerned about somebody's well-being. You might be concerned about what's happened to them in that incident, and they might be talking to you about that, but they might also not be doing. And I think that that first instance, that kind of belief and empathy is so important. Like in general, when we hear from people who've experienced sexual violence, we hear from them that at each stage where they report, they're met with something that feels to them like disbelief. So they're not, it's not immediately assumed that they're telling the truth and that that's happened to them. And sometimes, and I expect particularly in those acute medical situations, there might be some questions that really need answering. You might be genuinely, absolutely needing to be sure about what's happened to that person. Are they under the influence of alcohol currently? Have they taken something? And it's about finding ways to get that information and ask those questions without suggesting that by being under the influence of alcohol, they were deserving of what's happened to them. And we know that often happens when people report to other professionals. So it'll be, well, but what had you been drinking? You know, had you taken anything? Had you done this? Had you done that? And so I think getting that nuance is really tricky, because absolutely, if you're a medical professional in that emergency or acute situation, of course you need to know some of those things, not to make judgments, but simply to look after somebody and give them the care that they need. And then I think that's quite important. I think there's something really important as well about knowing when to take a disclosure further. So should you, as that healthcare professional, be reporting that incident to the police? And obviously everybody has to follow their own safeguarding processes, particularly if there's worry about an immediate harm to someone, and particularly if it's a child or a young person who's involved or somebody particularly vulnerable. But of course, not everybody wants police reports to happen. And I think understanding that and taking that on board where possible, and not just assuming that the first thing you need to do is call the police. Obviously, you need to follow safeguarding process, and we'd never tell you not to. But thinking about how you can do that in a as trauma-informed way as possible to allow for that person's consent as far as possible. Because, of course, sexual violence is all about taking away someone's consent and autonomy. So in those interactions afterwards, anything that you as a professional can do to restore some of that, to give some of that control back to that person, is really, really important.
Listen, that's a fantastic point, actually, and really honouring consent, both verbal and inferred, but just and almost being explicit maybe about that consent as well, because I think that's, like you said, it's probably been very covertly and subtly taken away from them, or not so subtly taken away from them, but yeah. But explicit saying, look, am I okay to do this, or am I okay to take your blood pressure? But just really reinstalling that consent back in there. Do you use chaperones quite a lot to in consultation meetings?
So yeah, we try, if people want to, absolutely, you know, like that's really important if that's what they want. We also have workers within our services called ISVAs, Independent Sexual Violence Advocates, and that's somebody who will support somebody who's experienced sexual violence, like through appointments as well. And sometimes that might include like a medical appointment, depending on like what kind of processes they're going through at the time. But yeah, so it's absolutely possible that they might have somebody with them in that capacity, or want somebody, and yeah, that they might feel a bit nervous about who they're in a small space with, and want some reassurance about who else is there and or who isn't there. And who might be listening or not listening. We know that these things happen in different spaces, don't they? You know, are you attending someone in a scene in a busy place, or are they in a tiny cubicle in a hospital? You know, not sure who's outside. So, yeah.
One thing I've started to try and do a lot more, just in my interviews actually, but also in clinical practice, is reiteration of message to show them I'm listening, but also to gain agreement, but make sure I'm getting the precise details of the account right. So it's almost like a read receipt, really. So this is what I'm hearing, this is what I'm understanding, just to let them know I'm listening as a first and foremost, but then just to make sure it is an accurate account, and they can sort of course correct me, because to your point, I think all these, you know, so maybe if it's been something that's happened quite recently, or indeed in the past hour or so, The flood of emotions are extremely visceral and extremely overwhelming sometimes. So it is getting that factual baseline and that factual chronological narrative is key. And but it's giving, I suppose, permission for the visceral emotion, but also trying to distill the factual sequence and chronology alongside that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we know that people might feel embarrassed about talking about some of these things. It might be the first time. We get a lot of people who will contact us as a first service and be saying like, this has happened to me. Is this rape? This has happened to me. Was that okay? You know, should I be upset about that? Am I okay to be upset about that? And I think that validation's really important. Like, yes, you know, mirroring their language, like checking in if they've used terminology, like checking in about what they mean. And but also, yeah, just being that sort of validation in the first instance, that if somebody's like asking, can I get help about this? I feel like I've had my consent taken away. I feel like I've been violated. I feel like this was sexual abuse, sexual assault. That, yes, that is okay to then seek help for that. You know, there isn't a threshold for which this has to have happened for us to call it something you need help with. Like, that's for you to decide. And I think that autonomy and empowerment is really important.
So Jane, just pivoting slightly and looking at the forensic elements, and maybe not, we don't have to do a deep dive into it, but to your point earlier around consent, and if there is consent to inform the police, I think sometimes, certainly within the paramedic service I work in, or indeed the ambulance service I work in, there's this sort of co-aligned response where they'll initiate the police, as well as, or the police will often call for the ambulance service. So the police are often on scene already. But just for maybe paramedics that are training and, you know, starting to get into the profession, it's not speaking out of turn to say that there would be a forensic element to maybe the police's line of inquiry. So they want to take maybe specimens or DNA samples. And is that something which sort of you're familiar with, sort of guiding people to seek if it's an immediate incident?
Yeah, sure. And obviously, yeah, forensic medical examinations usually want to gather any bodily fluid, skin, hair that might have been left by a perpetrator. They might ask the patient for a sample of blood or urine and other things, and also might want to examine them for physical injuries and physical evidence of harm. They might need photographs of that. So that can be something that that is needed. There are services called sexual assault referral centres, which predominantly are run within healthcare rather than outside in the voluntary sector where we work, that will have like staff who'll guide through all of that. And each trust will have some kind of commission service in that regard, where There is a protocol for how you access that service and how you get them involved. So there should be that kind of forensic level support, if you like, at that stage, really, really available. And they usually also give people the option to have that forensic medical examination done without necessarily reporting yet. So it gives people the opportunity to gather that evidence and to make sure that that's been collected and is being held somewhere securely safe and according to the kind of guidance that the forensic people need, without necessarily having to make that police report immediately if they're not ready to do that.
So I've got two questions, Jane, and they kind of intertwine between each other. One would be around sort of the short term and medium to long term effects of sexual assault, and then the second would be around what the sort of short, medium and or long term support mechanisms are available, because, you know, paramedics do see patients, or pre-hospital providers see patients, for such a short, finite amount of time. It's very much potentially at the start of what is a very long and difficult journey. Yeah. You mentioned before about this looking at the effects before we look at the support mechanisms, you know, this denial or this, or indeed checking, you know, confusion, you know, was this right? Was this not right? And this acute sort of moral confusion almost. Could you maybe speak to some of the other sort of facets you see along that journey, which aren't necessarily, I suppose, like to your earlier point, formulaic? Not everyone's going to have the same journey.
Yeah. So definitely we see all sorts of different responses. So you'll see people who you know, will cope, if you like, and present quite okay about something for a very long time, and then some reason will mean that they stop to. So, you know, sexual violence does affect women more than men, and it tends to be, for example, that childbirth or like some kind of intimate examination can be a trigger point in terms of medical intervention. Having your own children and them getting to an age where perhaps where that the person experienced abuse themselves can be a trigger. Familiar faces, you know, all sorts of different things can happen. And we see people very much going through cycles of, you know, you might have very acute responses, very, you know, panic attacks, trauma responses, really struggling to kind of deal with certain situations, maybe something like PTSD or something like presenting in that way. We might also see people who, you know, come in and out of that at different points and different times, and seek support and seek help for those things at different points and different times. There's no sort of like real linear recovery model in terms of, oh, somebody goes for six sessions of counselling and now that's fine and they'll be okay. You know, that might be now, and then 3 years later something might occur. We also know that lots and lots of people experience, unfortunately, sexual abuse and sexual assault at various points across their life. So that can be a compounding factor, if you like, in terms of that trauma being repeated.
And interestingly, it's an analog of grief in a way that, you know, grief is messy. It's not linear. It's often not reproducible, and is a whole roller coaster of emotion. And in the same way, I suppose the effects and the emotion from sexual assault is similar. There's no formulaic linear path. It's probably a time depending on each individual, actually, to your point. But just looking at the support mechanisms, I very much in the past, when I've been involved with rape victims or otherwise sexual assault and similar, it feels very ineffectual being there for an hour or two. It's an important part, you know, it's a conduit to take them to hospital, or indeed to take them to the next level of care, to feel like they're supported and getting that level of care. But could you maybe speak to some, say they do withdraw their consent and they're shut down, they're really recluse, they actually don't want any physical presence from anyone around, they don't want to report it, and I understand the police can still act in autonomy in that situation, but could you maybe speak to what paramedics could do to signpost towards short, medium and or long term support? Sure.
So first and foremost, there is now a 24/7 rape and sexual abuse support line. And that's something we at Rape Crisis England and Wales, we run that service. So that's now available as a telephone line and also as a web chat service 24 hours a day. So the web chat's particularly useful for people who don't want to vocalise something and aren't quite ready for that. And we also have with it like a lot of information on our website that people can read in order to kind of understand that their responses are quite regular, that people respond differently, that lots of people do shut down, that, you know, there are different things, and we'll also signpost them to further help and further information. So in the short term and the kind of that quick moment, if you like, there's always that. In terms of more long-term support, it really, really varies. There is not a kind of footprint that matches the NHS for sexual violence support. And I think it's probably like quite a controversial area in many ways because, you know, the NHS, if you like, and health don't fund like long-term specialist support for rape on the whole. They do have the SARCs, and you'll see some pockets in certain areas where there is extra support. But on the whole, it's provided outside in the voluntary sector from wherever people can get money to do it. So it will depend on the local area where you're working as to what your services might be and where you can send people. And, you know, there may be several and they may offer all sorts of different things, all the way through from like counselling to support through the criminal justice system to kind of group support and long term support. Or you might have, you know, simply a bit of counselling or something else. So it really, really varies. Again, most of that information can be found through our website of where people can go. So it is a good space to send people to on the whole, because we do try and signpost people to what they can find. But I think it is the tricky part, like that there is that support available, but it's not funded well. And you know, much like many of your listeners will experience, there are waiting lists and there isn't necessarily that instant access to support apart from the telephone line, the 24/7. So that does help in that regard. I would also say that in those instances, our telephone line will also take calls from professionals who want to know something or want some information. So if it did feel like you really wanted to leave somebody with a place to go, there'd be nothing stopping you from, if you couldn't easily find something in the area that you're working in, like dropping our line a call to ask there for them to give you something to pass on. And that's perfectly legitimate use of the line and something we see it really important that the professionals are supported to have this knowledge, because it tends not to be provided like institutionally or as a matter of kind of regular CPD for everyone. So if there's anything we can do on that, we do our best.
I think it's really important, actually, and I will put links in the show notes to Rape Crisis to the and the 24/7 line, because to your point, actually, Jane, I would love to support clinicians with that, so that as you said, it's a support mechanism where they can indeed support victims in the short or medium term to be able to reach out at the 3 a.m. or 4 a.m. or 5 a.m. when there's no one else around. Often the times when there is no one else around where they genuinely need the support. So Jane, could you maybe speak to, we've kind of notioned towards safeguarding and the needs of the patient. Could you, how much of safeguarding plays a central role within Rape Crisis, and how have you seen sort of safeguarding evolve over the past few years within sort of sexual assault?
So I think there's two different aspects to this. The first is when we've got children, young people, because obviously it's a very, very different situation. So obviously, like, if you know, sexual abuse and sexual assault is incredibly, incredibly serious, and you know, perhaps doesn't go without saying is a criminal offence. So if we've got a young person presenting, talking about being sexually abused or sexually assaulted, then there are safeguarding duties. There's a duty there that we do something about that. And that's really tricky when we're talking about like taking away someone's consent if they're not wanting that. But ultimately, it's a young person, like that is the pathway. And people should feel confident in their safeguarding kind of processes in terms of dealing with that. But I think there are more complex spaces around sexual abuse that's happening in, you know, intimate partner relationships and things like that, where somebody might disclose to you, but then actually might start to panic, might start to worry that the perpetrator, they still live with that perpetrator. And you might be in a situation where somebody's talking about something that's happened to them and saying, but I'm married, you know, is this rape? Is this sexual assault? And yes, it is. And sometimes that kind of reassurance is the best you can do. But they might not, you know, you don't know what situation people are in, and it can be really hard, can't it? And I suspect, especially in those acute moments where you're like coming across a patient for the first time, not aware of what else is going on and the other dynamics around. So I think that bit's particularly tricky. But ultimately, if you've got a concern about somebody or they're bringing a concern to you, then if you've got a duty to just act on that because of their age or their vulnerability, then yes, that's what you must do. But if you can kind of get consent from them in terms of what to do, or give them, either way, give them routes to help themselves, I think that's really important. We've definitely seen this shift, I would say, in the last few years in terms of both the way that safeguarding duties have changed, and our different understanding of safeguarding. You know, we recognise that there are safeguarding risks inside and outside the home, that peers can be a safeguarding risk, for example, and that there could be, we know something about how sexual exploitation happens in terms of criminal gangs and criminal activity and young people who get caught up in that, and all sorts of other things. It's not simply a case often of somebody presenting where it's really obvious what's happened, and it's really straightforward, and someone's run away having done something, who was a stranger and we don't know who they were. Like, there's so much more to it, isn't there? So, yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, absolutely, Jane, absolutely. And you're right, quite complicated sometimes, because like you said, these cases can be intertwined within a marital relationship, within people living together, within, yeah, it's just, there's, it's not, very, very rarely is it linear and blatantly obvious. It's often quite complicated.
And when we see sexual abuse happen over periods of time for people as well, like we need to remember that it's all about power and control. So when you've got someone in a situation with someone who's got some control over them, in whatever position that is, whether it is in an intimate partner relationship, whether it's a work relationship, whether it's a teacher, whether it's a professional in a different space, you know, we hear a lot about the abusive behaviours of police officers at the moment, which doesn't mean to say they all are doing that, but there are definitely people who exploit their positions. So, you know, being aware of some of that, but also thinking about how you then, as somebody in a uniform or with a badge, or, you know, might be viewed by that person who maybe doesn't trust people in authority because of something that's happened to them. So it's complicated.
Yeah, it's, and actually, really interestingly, it's a privileged position to wear a pre-hospital care uniform, sort of a paramedic, a ambulance technician uniform, but whereby you are getting almost sometimes undisclosed and uncensored access into people's most vulnerable points in their life, and almost on a consistent daily basis. And that's a massive privilege, actually, to bestow, but also just to navigate. And I think it's easy to forget that through, you know, the throes of fatigue and enduring shift patterns, but actually it is an amazingly privileged position, and to be able to assist and help in that time is also privileged. And so, just as we move on, Jane, and coming to land, can I just get you to speak to maybe an anonymized case which you have really seen benefit from immediate and or long-term support, you know, someone who may have really come through the system and done well through engagement, done well through a refined or defined community of people around them to bring them out of the other side of what otherwise would be a very traumatic experience.
Yeah, I think when you consider cases like this, the thing that most makes a difference at that start is that first interaction where somebody effectively believes you, you know, so they're coming across a medical professional and they're looked after and there's care given to them. There's a sense that they've still got some autonomy, you know, they're made to feel safe, but particularly they're believed, because in that moment, there's no, it doesn't matter, does it? You know, you're not involved in that criminal investigation. You know, all that matters is that you give that person space where they're safe to talk and to kind of get what they want. And then we hear about, yeah, that really sensitive kind of help through those medical examinations, understanding that it's horrible, that you've just been through like a horribly traumatic experience that's really violated your personal space. And then you have to go through some kind of intimate medical examination, potentially, that's really going to, at some level, be a repeat of some of that. So the sensitivity around that, giving people time and space, you know, the kindness of somebody who will just ask if they want someone else in the room, who will ask them if they want to take a minute, who will get a cup of tea, or, you know, the kind word and the small gesture, they matter, don't they? They matter so much in those instances, and really kind of validating and affirming that person. And then I think it's really about making sure they've got that knowledge about where to go for help. And I think it's really, really hard for services on this because, you know, you can't know whether that person's going to get help by any of those services. We know that it's, yeah, they've got to go when they're ready. And there's also got to be a service available for them that they can use. But like that signposting into that service, I think, is really, really important. And ideally, you know, a little bit of kind of understanding enough about your local service to be able to give some useful information about it. So to reassure them about confidentiality, to reassure them about anonymity. If they want to phone the helpline, they don't give their name. We don't know where they live. You know, they don't need to give any information like that. And I think there's some really simple things there, particularly if you're working in one local area that might have one or two local services, that you could just almost like have that knowledge and information ready to pass on. I think we'd love to see that, and we hear so much about how that makes a difference to people in terms of that journey. And also, of course, there are like sometimes in these situations very acute physical medical needs that sit alongside whatever assault's happened. So if someone's been injured in other ways, like that sensitive treatment kind of continuing throughout and recognizing the trauma that someone's experienced where possible, and how to kind of deal with that and accommodate that is really helpful.
Jane, listen, that's absolutely fantastic and really succinct, and it actually encompasses everything I wanted to capture, actually. So thank you so much for your perspectives. I think we'll put in the show notes links to Rape Crisis. We'll also put links to the 24/7 number and indeed some of the references you put in earlier, just so that professionals can indeed refer back to these services. But it just leaves me to say thank you, Jane, because it's such a diverse range of services out there, and it's really nice to be able to give cohesive answers and indeed comment from your anecdotal experience across the board. So thank you.
You're welcome.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast on the Medics Academy Network.